This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight because he's still in Wellington being important, and me, Samuel Mann. I'm joined by Sky Duncan, who is the director of the Global Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO. NACTO is the National Association of City Transportation Officials, based in New York, I think.
Yes, that's right.
But she's not from New York. She's from here, Dunedin.
I'm from Dunedin.
So my usual question of where did you grow up? Where'd you grow up?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I was born in Papua New Guinea and lived there till I was seven, and then came to Dunedin. Both my parents are Kiwis. And so, yeah, moved here when I was about seven and came into primary school and did all my high schooling years here and then left to go to university. So it's really awesome to be home. It's great.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
You know, I didn't know, actually. Well, at one point I wanted to be a set designer. I loved maths and I loved painting and artwork. So some, I loved chemistry. So some combination of something that was problem solving yet creative. And I started off thinking about doing engineering. My big brother is an engineer and he talked me into that. So I did a year at Canterbury and then switched to architecture and ended up doing my architecture degree up at Victoria in Wellington. So I don't know what I wanted to be, but I'm happy where I ended up.
I wanted to be a set designer. That was the thing I wanted to do.
That's awesome.
We couldn't find anywhere that took it sort of seriously enough. It was a it was okay as a hobby, but it hadn't yet grown into design. Hadn't become a thing.
Yeah, for sure. No, I think certainly in some parts of the world now it'd be a pretty amazing.
So you found yourself doing architecture.
Yeah, so I did architecture and then did a bit of work in private practice as a in a landscape architecture firm, Wright & Associates in Wellington. Had done a bit of work in the States for a guy in LA, and then ended up working for Ian Athfield at Athfield Architects in Wellington. Did that for a few years. Fascinating, you know, just learned so much and, you know, working on everything from individual houses, residential, to university campuses and waterfronts. And it was really there that I kind of developed or realized my passion for the kind of urban scale and designing cities. And that from that process, I ended up applying for a Fulbright scholarship and going over and doing my master's in New York City at Columbia in architecture and urban design.
Is that urban scale taught in architecture?
It is a little bit. It's more of a kind of a one-off elective, you know. So as you're going through architecture school, you take an elective that's called urban design and you start to think about bigger scale and some of the complexities of designing cities. But it's a light touch, I would say. Maybe now it's a bit heavier in the curriculum in New Zealand. I'm not 100% sure, actually. It's been a while. So I went to New York for a year and it's been 11. So it's a bit crazy.
So Urban Design 101.
Yeah. Well, so urban design is really thinking about cities. And so it's taking all little bits of the languages of architecture, planning, landscape architecture, policy, and pulling all of these aspects together and understanding as a designer, how can you try and have a positive impact, whether it's environmentally, economically, socially, for overall livability. So, you know, the design decisions that we make, whether it's literally the angle of the back of a park bench, right, which will define whether an elderly person is comfortable spending time in a plaza or a street corner, to an entire neighborhood, to citywide policies around public health and environment, you kind of learn to speak a little bit of all the languages. And I used to say to my students in New York, you know, you don't have to be an expert. You don't have to become a hydrologist, but you have to learn to understand the importance of water moving through urban environments. Same thing with policy, same thing with how business and economies work. So you have to learn a little bit and know when to pull the right person to the table to make responsible decisions around the future built environments that we're all living in and what we leave for our next generation.
Just to carry on going through your timeline, so you did a master's?
Yep.
In architecture?
Yep, a Master of Science in Architecture and Urban Design. So it was a very intensive 12-month master's in New York. And then the City of New York was setting up a new urban design office, and this was something that existed in the 60s, actually. And it was kind of phased out through, a shift in mayor or a change in political administration. And the woman at the time, Amanda Burden, she was the commissioner of the Department of City Planning under Mayor Bloomberg when he was mayor. And she was very passionate about design. And so she recreated this team. And so in 2007, right after I graduated, I joined that team. And, it was funny. Initially, I thought, oh, gosh, I don't know. What does it mean to be an urban designer for the city? I don't want to get stuck making massing models. And so I had a number of interviews actually when I went back to try and understand. And a couple of the guys that had just started, they said, look, we're also learning what this means. So come and join the team and we're going to help define this. And so it was an amazing adventure. I thought I'll do it for a year or so.
So was there like a brief, or did someone have an idea that it was a good idea and let's see where it goes?
I mean, there was a director who set the division up, and we were really looking at how do we bring more visual thinking and creative problem solving to the planning world. So typically planners, departments of planning, around the world, they look a lot at demographics, they look a lot at plans and policies, and they might say, right, this is going to be an R62, the R means residential, the 6, relates to a density, and the 2, some other details around that. And we kind of would say, well, why don't we need to go and look and walk the streets and the sidewalk and understand what do we want to see here? And let's draw what we want to see here. Let's model it. Let's understand what that looks and feels like from the perspective of someone walking down the street or living in that neighborhood. And then let's create the policies to support that. And so that was really part of our role, was to bring that very visual thinking and modeling to how the Department of City Planning worked and how they visualized and imagined the future for the city.
Where do the problems or the opportunities come from?
Well,
are there things that have had to already like bubble right up to the top to this is now a project?
It's a total mixture, to be honest. So some new projects and issues come from private developers coming in and saying, this is what we want to do. And so you're playing kind of more of a reactionary role where you say, okay, fine, if you want to do that, let's look at the context, let's understand it. Is there a need for that in the neighborhood? What are the other public benefits that we might get if we build X, Y, and Z on these sites? But we also made a big part of our job was to be proactive and not just wait for people to come with ideas, but to say, okay, what do we want the city to be? And the Mayor Bloomberg actually had a really great document called Plan NYC, and it said, okay, we're going to have 1 million new people living in New York by the year 2030. What do we want that to look like and feel like? How, we want every resident to be within a 10-minute walk of a park. We want our buildings to be sustainable and eco-friendly, and we want to promote renewable energy. We want healthy water, we want close access to schools. And so then we proactively went out and looked at where there are what we called soft sites in the city. So where there was kind of ripe areas for development. And so we really try and say, how do we keep and preserve and enhance what's great about a place? And then how do we look to improve the things that aren't so great?
And what's the role of the people in that process?
So the community plays a big role. Anytime, it's a very complex system, and I won't go into the details, but essentially there's a bunch of policies and meetings. So if anyone wants to change anything, there's the zoning resolution. If you want to change that legal policy of what can be built, you have to go out and talk to the community. They get to have a say. You have a number of meetings. There's a big hearing, City Planning Commission, and then eventually a city council has to vote to make those changes. So it's a pretty long process. It can take multiple years. But the community, everyone can come and say what they think, and they have big meetings, and you get, you know, whatever it is, 60 seconds for someone like for a project and 60 seconds for someone against, and you ping pong back and forth until everybody's had their say. And honestly, sometimes you sit there till 2 in the morning. But, you know, it's important that you understand the local expertise. We can come in as with professional expertise to say, this is what we know is best practice. This is what's being done around the world. This is what we believe is best. But, you know, we don't necessarily live on that street or send our kids to that specific school. And so understanding what the needs are from the local community are always really important. And so we would often say as urban designers, we're like in the seesaw, right? And our role is to balance the needs of the public and still be able to allow cities to grow and flourish and attract new development.
Do people sometimes have, I'm not sure what they're called in planning, but like the post hoc solutions to things that
where
people have walked across the grass and, you know, maybe that's where the path should be.
Absolutely. Kind of yeah, the desire line. I love those because you just look, and actually this is something I often say, particularly now in our work looking at public space, is if you look at how people use a space, that actually tells us almost 90% of what we should be doing there. And so we have to look to what the people want. You know, a desire line, or I think they're also called like goat's trails. You'll see if there's medians, and we see this in Bogota and Colombia where we're working, big medians and giant roads, and every kind of 100 meters or so, all the grass is worn away and people want to cross the street and there's no crossing, but of course they do it, right? And so we look at those as signals in the built environment to say, hey, this is how we should change the built environment to support how people want to use it. It's the same as if somewhere's got no seating and you see people perching on, you know, fire hydrants and leaning up against the wall. They want to stay and spend time in a space, in a public space. And so we should be providing seating for that. So it's really great. It's one of my favorite things. It's like observing almost like animals, you know, but observing how animals and human beings, what are our instinctual uses of public space and cities and our neighborhoods? And then how do we as designers help support that?
So you went from the working at the city to, I've lost its name, there it is, National Association of City Transportation Officials.
Yep.
And director of the Global Designing Cities Initiative. That's a long job title.
I know, it's ridiculously long. One day we're going to find a way to make it shorter.
So tell us who NACTO is first.
Yeah, sure. So NACTO is the National Association of City Transportation Officials, and it's a very long title for a very cool club or association of essentially people who work in transportation in the United States. So it's focused on North America and the US. And what they do is they basically have an annual gathering. We pull practitioners, city officials together every year to kind of share best practices and what's happening. We help to, it essentially represents all of those cities in the US. So in terms of lobbying for state and national policy change, all of those cities can come together and say, we, the cities of the US, for the local government level, this is what we want to see happen. And one of the really key things that NACTO does over the last few years is create design guidance. Now, what's really key about this is what we were seeing, or what we are still seeing everywhere, is that in cities, if we think about our streets, they're our largest continuous network of public space. And what we were getting were essentially highway codes or highway design standards that are all about moving cars as quickly as possible being applied to our urban environments. Now, of course, we want our cities and our neighborhoods to be about people, not about cars. And so there was a complete mismatch here. Now, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who she was actually the transportation commissioner under Mike Bloomberg in New York City, the one that closed Times Square and bought in bike share and all that great stuff. She's the chair of NACTO, and she's an incredible woman, not the most patient person in the world. And so she said, all right, to change these codes at the national level is going to take, you know, multiple years. Why don't we pull all the best practices from the cities together? We create a new set of guidance, and then we have that endorsed by the big US cities. And so that's what they did. They created what was called the Urban Street Design Guide, that has since been endorsed by 50 cities and 9 states. And now the US federal level is looking and agreeing that, yes, this is the type of guidance, design guidance for our streets we want in our cities. And they have, it's really great because people can email each other with everyday problems and say, listen, I'm trying to put a bike share station on a hill and I'm having issues with drainage and accessibility. How did everyone else solve this? And a little email club goes around. Someone says, hey, well, actually, we had the same problem in San Fran. Here's what we did. Hey, here's what we did in Philadelphia. And so this idea that we don't have time to reinvent the wheel every time and that we can learn from each other's mistakes and successes is a key part of that kind of network of people and practitioners working together. And so that was incredibly successful at the US level. And so Jeanette called me up one day when I was working at the city and said, hey, I'd love you to come over and apply for this job to essentially emulate that process, but on an international or a global scale. And that's how I ended up as the director of the Global Designing Cities Initiative.
So where do you start?
Yeah, good question. I think so. I spent a few weeks and then I was like, what have I done taking on this job? How on earth could anyone, you know, try and propose a set of guidelines for how you design streets all around the world, right? From, you think, like, Dunedin to Addis Ababa in Ethiopia to New York City. Like, it's insane. And so I realized very, very quickly one of the most successful parts of NACTO was the network. And so I reached out to all my contacts and, you know, professional network, and we very quickly created a network of practitioners and professionals and city officials and academics who work in this realm around the world. And we made them co-authors or contributors to this guide. We pulled all the best practices together, kind of abstracted them a little bit, refined them where needed, and then started to turn this into you know, a series of before and after of showing people what's possible based on real life projects, you know, that have been built, that have been implemented. And so it's essentially, you know, a set of guidance created by cities for cities. And what we realized very quickly actually was that regardless of if we're talking about streets in Dunedin or Addis Ababa in Ethiopia or Bogota, you know, we're all quite different. Our contexts are quite different. But fundamentally, each of these places are about human beings. And so regardless of our skin color or our accent or the language that we speak, we're pretty much fundamentally roughly the same size. We move roughly at the same speed. We have the same human senses. And so the whole premise to shift the hierarchy that, you know, that we've been designing our cities for 50, 60 years with the car at the heart of all of our design and policy decisions. And it's insane when we look at all the numbers, it's ridiculous. So if we actually just invert that and put people first, a people priority approach to designing our streets, public spaces, and our cities, it doesn't matter if we're in Dunedin or Bogota or Addis Ababa. And so that became the underlying principle through the whole set of guidance. And that's the biggest hurdle we're doing, is inverting that hierarchical pyramid where the car has been king to now put the pedestrian as the queen or king of the public space of our cities, and then to prioritize sustainable mobility choices like cycling and transit, you know, public transit, then making sure we can deliver goods and provide city services. And when we have space, then we give that space to the private car. And this, of course, is insanely controversial.
Right? I was going to say, because it's a contested space.
Yeah.
And there are people driving around with big lumps of metal that are a ton, 3 tons more.
Yeah.
And it does seem to be a might is right and speed is right attitude. How do you overcome that?
It's actually pretty basic. We just talk about a lot of the numbers that are out there. Speed is one of the number one killers on our roads. I think in New Zealand last year, 328 people died. And I think I saw the news last night, 2017, we've already surpassed that, right? And we can do something about that. We can lower speeds and we can make our cities safer. So there's a whole speed argument where it's one of the 10 leading causes around the world. So we have 1.25 million people are dying every year. It's equivalent of one person every 30 seconds dying on our streets around the world. So that's somebody's child or mother or family member or friend. And we have the power to avoid that. It's totally preventable. So one is just the fundamental need to save lives and to avoid these preventable deaths. I can talk for hours about the numbers around road safety, the environmental side of it, right, that our cars and our modes of transportation are contributing to carbon emissions and our climate. And I know this is also contested, but less so as each year goes on, all the challenges around climate change. And we're seeing even the East Coast with that 5 hurricanes coming through and destroying environments. Cars and transportation are one of the key leading factors to climate change and our carbon emission levels. Public health around chronic disease, physical inactivity, another one of our global leading causes of death. We've designed physical activity out of our daily lives. You know, we drive everywhere rather than walk or bike. But one of the most powerful set of numbers, I think, is when we talk about the efficiency of space. So, you know, we can talk about road safety, public health, environment. But if you take 3 meters of space, right, and that's essentially what a standard travel lane is, ideally. If you look at how many people we can move by cars, by sidewalks, by bikes, or people on foot, people on bikes, in that 3 meter space, private cars is the least efficient way that we can move people. So actually, if you think of an equity standpoint, or the fact that all of us are taxpayers contributing to the design of this public space, if it's only serving one user, which is the person in the car, we're really not being very smart about how we're investing that money. And we often talk about the street, the street almost like real estate, right? When we think of the value of real estate and you get down to the square inch or square meter of space and the value of that, if we applied that same way of thinking of value to our streets and we understand that they have to help treat our water and improve our air quality and move as many people and help our businesses flourish, the numbers all very much show that making them all for private cars is not the right move.
It sounds convincing, but somehow we have to change the narrative to one that accepts that and not start with, but this is going to take away 5 car parks.
Yeah, so a big part of what we do is actually collecting metrics. And we know that, you know, well, as Mike Bloomberg, who's our funder through this at Bloomberg Philanthropies, he always says, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. And so, absolutely, you take away 5 car parks, and I guarantee in most places everyone starts complaining and their business is going to go under and what have the rest of you. So what we do in many cases is we say, all right, we'll trial it. Let's see what happens. So we can take away the car parks. And this, you know, Copenhagen, Melbourne, they've been taking away 2% of car parks every year for the last 30 years. And then we measure things. So this is what we did in Times Square, right? We closed it. They say, you're going to close Times Square, one of the busiest intersections in the world. You're insane. And Jeanette, our chair, was like, okay, well, we'll trial it for 6 months and let's see. If it works, we'll keep it. If it doesn't work, we'll give it back to all of the cars. And so they measured the air quality, they measured the businesses, they measured qualitative if people preferred it, they put GPSs in the taxis and the buses to measure the average speeds of the vehicles, they measured the safety. All the numbers were positive. Less people were injured, less people were dying, vehicles were actually moving more efficiently, not faster, that's a different way of thinking, right? More efficiently. 74% of people preferred it. Businesses did hugely well. And so then you can go back and say, okay, well, let's make this permanent, right? Because there's always naysayers. And so if if we trial it, and then we can see often what we've found is actually businesses do a whole lot better when they're not lined fully with car parking, because it's actually the space of one empty metal box. The metal box doesn't spend money. People do. So if that space is instead a space for 5 or 10 people to sit or a few people to park their bikes, you know, and you want to think creatively about that curbside management, we actually get more people spending time on the street, enjoying the spaces, buying more coffee, buying more things. The numbers often show, not in 100% of the cases, but the numbers more often than not show positive outputs when we design for multimodal use and not just for movement, but for people to stay in our streets.
Is that trialing it something of a general approach that it's worth giving it a go?
Absolutely. This was a lot of what we started in New York City. We've seen cities around the world doing similar approaches. We're now working in 5 cities around the world doing similar work. So probably about 3 weeks ago now, I was in a city, Fortaleza, in the north of Brazil. We took a whole downtown area that was a car park, kind of a road. It was a mess, complete mess. And we transformed it over 72 hours, painting through the night. It was meant to stay there for 15 days. We collected all the metrics beforehand. We're still in the process of doing the after. But people were saying within hours that they wanted this to stay in and become permanent. We had one business owner say he'd only ever seen fights out in front of his store and he'd never seen kids playing, and now they were out there and enjoying the public space. Another woman took it on her own initiative to start a petition. She collected this was a few weeks ago, so maybe more, number of signatures. To say that 6 pages of signatures, to say they wanted this to be permanent. So the key is we're always going to have those 5 taxi drivers or those couple of businesses or a few people saying they hate change and they don't want this to happen. And when we talk about metrics and evaluation, what we really want to do is collect more data and more information to have a fair conversation about this. Say, okay, fine, maybe 4 or 5 taxi drivers, this is harder and you hate it and it's the worst thing in the world that's ever happened. But you know what? We also spoke to 300 people and 84% of those people said they loved it and wanted it permanent. And that's often not what we're not very good at, is having that fair conversation about how to use this very disputed space called our streets.
Now, you've put this together in a fabulous looking book, The Global Street Design Guide.
Yep.
Which is downloadable.
It is, for free. Yeah, we were very excited. We negotiated very hard and finally got we bought the rights out from the publishers so that we could make it a free download. You can buy the hard copy, but it's essentially accessible to anyone in the world, which is great.
So how's the book laid out?
It's a very visual document. And so what we wanted to do was make sure that we could make it accessible. We say, you know, to be able to inspire leaders, inform practitioners, and to empower communities to know what to ask for or demand of their space. So you can literally open it. I think we did over 120 3D models for this. So you don't have to be a technical person or a practitioner who works in urban design or transportation to understand this. It's literally before and after images where people can look at a context that looks a little bit like what they might know or feel familiar with and look across the page and see what's possible and to say, I want this. Why can't we have this local, you know, to a local politician, we want streets that look like this in our neighborhood, or for a politician to stand up and say, we think we see opportunities like this in our city, in our neighborhood. So it's really meant to give enough technical information for the practitioners working in this, but to be very accessible to those who don't speak this language every day, but to still understand the value of streets and public space.
And I would imagine that most of the things that in this book are moving curbs or painting or plantings and so on. The return on investment must be much, much greater than building new roads or large infrastructure.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome point, actually. So we had a lot of discussions with this. So the network I was mentioning, we had over 40 countries and 70 cities represented in this network, giving advice and contributing to this. And a lot of people said, well, what about new streets? What about new designs? And what we decided was, you know, yep, it's great. If we're designing brand new streets, yes, it's important that they're designed well and properly in an efficient and sustainable way. But if we look at our cities, the bulk of our built environment is already established. It's already there. So if we don't actually go back and ask what's possible of how we transform those spaces, then we're going to be in serious trouble. You know, we can't only think of the new stuff. We have to go back and retrofit and rethink and redesign our current swaths of asphalt that we have as these kind of hardcore veins running through all of our cities. And the cool thing is that they're often actually really overbuilt. I mean, here in New Zealand, not so much in some of the contexts we work in Latin America or in Europe, where our streets are very narrow and they were essentially designed before the car came along. But we've overbuilt so many of our streets now that there's actually huge opportunity to go back and put in protected bike lanes, to widen sidewalks, to put in great areas of green infrastructure that can help us manage our, you know, more frequent flooding that we're seeing all the time. I know in here in Dunedin, right, earlier this year, big floods. So the opportunity is huge. And that's one of my favorite diagrams in the book. At the front is called What is Possible? And it's essentially asking people to kind of put on a pair of glasses that says, you know, go out and look at your street. Ask what's possible. Ask what could be better about this. If you have the power to change it, do it. If you can design it differently, do it. If you can demand or advocate for something more from your street, do it. You know, do whatever you can in your power to fight for streets that put people first.
I'm not sure that you would advocate for guerrilla actions, but people do those sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that's, sometimes I feel like we're doing guerrilla actions. We work directly with city government, so they are obviously bought into this process, but that's often how we feel and how it ends up working is we're out there in the middle of the night, in the dark, you know, where there's not as much traffic, to paint the street so that in the morning here's a new canvas for urban life and urban movement. And, you know, what's incredible about whether it's organized or more informal guerrilla action, I should be careful I don't get myself in trouble here, but it does, it helps people understand what's possible, what we were just saying. It helps people understand a different reality. And, you know, a bit of paint and some lawn chairs and some planters, people have just often never even thought about their streets for anything other than movement because they haven't experienced it. So if someone's never experienced something other than what's at their front door, then how do you know what to demand or ask for? And so that is a really powerful part of the guerrilla action, is that it can give people a chance to experience a new form of public space or a new definition of what streets are. And the other very powerful part of it is it can lower people's stress about change. And we're funny creatures, you know, us human beings. We don't tend to love change. The odd person does, but these actions can help people not get so stressed. If it doesn't work out, it's only here for a week or a month and it will come back, you know?
One of the things that I often think when somebody is ranting about how you can't do this because it's going to take away car parks or whatever the argument is if only these people could visit Scandinavia.
Yeah.
Because people just, I don't think people have actually experienced this sort of thing working.
Exactly.
But it's not just in Scandinavia, because I'm flipping through the book here while you're talking and there's examples from all over the show.
Yep, increasingly so.
So where are the best examples?
Literally all over. I mean, I think, you know, Scandinavia for sure are some of our, you know, poster children, the Copenhagens and the Stockholms and Helsinki's and Amsterdam's. Well, it's not Scandinavia, but, you know, the kind of European examples. And one of the funny things with that is everyone says, oh, you know, I go and do these lectures around the world and everyone says, oh, you know, whatever sky, like we're not Copenhagen, why are you showing us these pictures? But the before pictures of Copenhagen from 30 years ago show that Copenhagen wasn't Copenhagen. and that they've been able to transform their cities, all of these places, through very proactive decisions around policy and design. You know, these designs didn't drop out of the sky or magically appear. Professionals and advocates and policymakers all made different decisions around that. So that's really very exciting to see out of Europe and Scandinavia. But, you know, honestly, we're also seeing incredible work and very quick action through these types of transformations of our streets coming out of Mexico City, Bogota, Buenos Aires. I just came directly from New Zealand from Buenos Aires. They're taking their entire downtown street networks, really making it harder for private cars. But, and this is the key, actually, this is really important to have a fair conversation about this, is to not only make it harder for private cars, but at the same time to prioritize and invest sustainable transportation options. So we have to give people an alternative. If we want to say, leave your car at home, we have to make sure people have access to things like car share, electric car share, or bike share, or e-bike share, right? Great for Dunedin's Hills if you can get an e-bike up and down. But if you don't have to, if you don't have to take a car for every single trip, it's not about saying you can't own a car or you can never use a car. But if we can make safe environments for people to bike and walk to school or the local park or the supermarket or to see their friends, then that just means we can rethink our streets in an entirely new way. And so that's what a part of it is really just looking at making, it's that balancing it. We make one side harder, but we make the other options more comfortable and more affordable and more desirable as an everyday decision. And so this is the type of stuff we're seeing happening, Europe, London, all throughout the US, Latin America, Australia, just across the ditch. Really awesome examples out of Melbourne through retrofitting their laneways and rethinking their downtowns. Bourke Street, Swanson Street, a lot of the kind of more transit-orientated streets that put people in transit and bikes first. Auckland we showcased actually with the recent shared streets that are up there, which are awesome because they kind of give that space to pedestrians as a priority in green infrastructure and seating. Cars can still go, so if someone's in a wheelchair or you're delivering something, you know, you can still access, but you move at like 10k an hour. And we're starting to see some of that here, which is awesome. And in the Warehouse District, I've just saw the other day under construction is the first little pedestrian street on Jetty Street, right, in Dunedin. So it's starting to see some of the stuff happen, which is really awesome. So I hope in the next iteration of the Global Street Design Guide, we can actually hopefully showcase some of the case studies from Dunedin.
So I have friends in Sweden and in Stockholm, actually outside of Stockholm in Tumba, friends in London who not only don't have a car, would find having a car to be a real nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
It would actually be a bad thing for them to have.
Yeah.
But they do have the whole urban design is set up that the kids can walk to school without coming in contact with a car. They can walk to the train. And the city has a car sharing system.
Yeah.
So that if they do need a car, there's one available. We're so far away from that that it's just moving a little bit like worthwhile or possible.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course it is. I mean, if we don't, I mean, we know it's none of this is a matter of if anymore. It's just a matter of when. And certainly we're going to see different cities and countries moving at different paces to achieve this. But we know as an urbanizing world and with our increasing challenges that we're being faced with, that there's not a lot of choices. It's going to look and feel a little different in every place, but this is the direction that we're going. So as far as I'm concerned, we should just be, I mean, cities like Dunedin, my goodness, we're so nimble and we have this Kiwi ingenuity. Like we should be going out there and showing the world how it's done. Quite frankly, we don't have that many excuses. Like the context that I work in and you see the challenges that these guys have. We think we've got a lot of challenges and I'm not trying to undermine the real challenges that do exist here. But if we step back and take a bit of perspective, my goodness, you know, we could really be showing the world how it's done here. So I say we're going to get there anyway, rather than inch along super slowly and be the trailers in the game. Why aren't we out there being the global leaders and saying, this is how it's done. This is how we can transform great little cities. And you know.
Do we know what the magical number is of the percent of people not in cars that it suddenly become, we've done it, or not necessarily there?
I don't know if there's a magical number like that. I think, you know, we often use the excuse here that we don't have the density for public transportation and to invest in that. But you look, and I understand the challenge here with city and national investment. And so this is something I think that cities can do a lot, but it has to become a part of the national conversation as well. Because it's just a matter of priorities, right? You look at Europe and they value public transportation as a public good. So they invest in that and they make sure that their citizens have access to that. And we just don't do that in the same way. It's not to say that it can't be done, but it does require us making some different decisions. It also, to be fair, is very, you know, we're focusing on transportation and streets right now, but this is also, when you look at the broader perspective of urban design, it's also fundamental that you integrally tie these decisions around public space and transportation with density and land use decisions. Because like you said, for your buddies in outside of Stockholm, you have to make sure that people have that playground or that school or that supermarket within that close walking distance, right? So it's looking at putting the right services near where people live, but also making sure our downtowns are fostering a mixed-use living environment with people living downtown in urban environments to give that choice to people. And I've already talked to a few people in Dunedin just in this last week who are saying like, oh, I'd love to live in a downtown apartment, but it doesn't really exist yet.
And we can retrofit that.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely.
So once you fix the streets,
yeah,
what's next?
Well, it's probably the other two things I'm saying. It's definitely looking at the public transportation system. So it's the streets and the systems of movement on it. But then it next is looking at what I would say kind of the soft sites or the areas of the city. I mean, if we're talking Dunedin specifically, where you could get more of that mixed use happening. So, you know, with, again, seeing it a bit in the warehouse district, but, you know, the waterfront is a very logical next step. Figuring out, and I think the city's already starting to think about this, but, you know, figuring out some basic connections across what's currently severing us from our waterfront, the rail lines and some of the one-way systems, lowering the speeds, having at-grade uses and reasons for people to go down there. But also looking at our areas around the university, around George Street and some of the inner city suburbs where, that's all walking distance. They're all walking distance or a short bike ride or e-bike ride from each other. So you could very feasibly live in Dunedin without a car. Most students do, right?
Is it, though, a wicked problem? Is it unsolvable? And I'm thinking of the, if I think of the cycleway, which might in one decade get built out to Port Chalmers.
Yeah.
And the very example you just used there about, yes, we can have a cycleway, but it's actually going to make the separation from the communities and the water worse.
Well, it depends how it's designed.
Well, the one we're going to get is going to be a fence.
Okay, I haven't seen the detailed design.
Well, neither have anybody, okay. But the one that they've half built already, okay. The one out to St. Leonard's,
yeah.
They've fenced off the railway.
Okay.
To protect the cyclists from the railway.
Yeah.
Which means that you now can't get across to the water.
To the, okay.
So when you start fiddling with these sorts of things, it sort of just gets exponentially more complicated.
It does. I mean, again, design plays a fundamental role. So if you look at, this is why it's important to kind of take a step back, and this is what urban designers often do, right, is take a step back, look at what are we trying to achieve. Going back to one of the first things you mentioned, what are the desire lines of where people want to go, both today and in the future, once we understand the city we want to become? And then we design the connections and the spaces so that they support that. So you can design bike facilities where they have to stop and pedestrians are the priority to cross. Rail lines are trickier, not just here. All around the world we see this problem. But again, it's not impossible. Like St. Andrew Street has an at-grade crossing across the rail line, both for cars and pedestrians, right? So there's no reason. There may be a policy somewhere that says that's not allowed. But just because a policy exists today, it doesn't mean that it has to exist for the next 100 years or 50 years. So we have to be proactive and say, what do we want to become? How do we protect and enhance what's we love and what's great? And how do we improve what's not so great? And then where are the impediments that exist for us to get there? Some of them are going to be political. Some of them are very detailed policies. Some are going to be in changing mindsets. It's all of it, right? And then we can identify how we get to the goals and the vision that we want to.
So that's the blueprint for being an urban designer.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about being collaborative and participatory in that, what do we as the community do
mm-hmm.
to achieve that?
Well, I think there will always be some community members who will say we don't want any of it. So that'll be one part of it. For those people who want to see these types of change, I would say speak out about it. Find a way to make your voice heard. Talk to the local radios or the newspapers, or find out who your local politicians are and send them a letter and say, listen, this is kind of stuff we would love to see in our community. It's absolutely worldwide practice that people who have the most to say are often against the anti-change. They're against anything that's happening. And so it's really important, I think, when we talk about community engagement, is to be creative and innovative as urban designers, as city officials, or as people like yourself working in the communication world, to think about how we provide a platform for people to give positive feedback for the types of things they want to see, not have it always just be about the negative. And that's a lot in the kind of technical assistance we give around the world with the cities that we work with. We don't only work with the planning and transportation and design agencies. We actually work with the local media and communications to make sure that they can help proactively understand why these things are happening and what are the benefits of them and how do people put their support behind it.
Are you going to stay in New York?
It's funny, I probably only spend about a week a month there at the moment with the amount of travel. So I literally hop between Ethiopia, India, Brazil, Colombia, most of the time. I don't know. I mean, it's pretty amazing being able to go and help some of these countries make these changes. I mean, I wouldn't have changed for anything the experience of learning and working in New York City. It's phenomenal. But there was always something in the back of my mind that I knew I wanted to go and help developing contexts, because New York certainly has problems. But when you look at the bigger world, you know, they have so little resources. And to be able to help these guys kind of try and leapfrog the mistakes that we know we've made in so many of these kind of Western developed contexts of designing our cities for cars, these cities actually have a chance to leapfrog that. Like Addis Ababa has 4% of the population drives, you know, 96 take transit and walk. So there's your perfect platform for not having to build all that infrastructure and spend the billions and billions of dollars on roads and highways and bridges that don't need to be there, that most other places are now tearing down. So I don't know. For now, it's still pretty amazing being able to go and travel and help these other places. But of course, it's phenomenal to come back here to Dunedin and visit my home country and do what I can. I mean, I'm not here in any really a formal capacity, but happy to help wherever I can.
Okay, some questions to end with. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I think it has to be the more traditional in terms of it has to be environmentally, but economically, and also looking at social equity. So a much more holistic or deeper definition versus the kind of greenwashing version of it, which sadly has become quite common.
What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I'd have to say the completion and the release of the Global Street Design Guide has been an incredible feeling to achieve that.
How are you getting it out to the cities?
How are we getting it out? So we've launched an endorsement campaign. So we've had over 30 cities and 15 organisations endorse the guide so far. Auckland has been the first one, and I'm hoping Dunedin will be the second one in New Zealand. So that's open to anyone. We have kind of every couple of months we host webinars so that people around the world can sign up and be a part of this conversation. And where I can, where I have time, I'll go and do talks, and my team is off doing the same thing around the world. So,
and it's online. How do people find it?
It's on our website. So if you go to www.globaldesigningcities.org, and one of the tabs is the guide. And so you can download it or find more information on endorsing it there as well.
We're writing a book of these conversations. We're calling it Tomorrow's Heroes.
Awesome.
So what's your superpower?
Oh, superpower. Maybe empowerment. I don't know if that really works, but to try and empower other people to see what's possible. Maybe it's like a pair of magic glasses or something to hand out to people and show them what's possible.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yeah, kind of. Not in the traditional sense, but whether I'm in private sector or local polis, local government, or in non-profit, I think it's important to be an activist. Challenging the status quo.
What motivates you?
A better world. And seeing and feeling change quite immediately.
And what challenges are you looking forward to the next couple of years?
I'm looking forward to, we're about to embark on a supplement to this guide, actually called Streets for Kids. So I'm kind of really excited to delve into that and get into some more of the detail of looking at what it means for kind of the young folk of our world and their engagement with the streets and public space. But also I think one of the biggest challenges that we're having now, and I don't have the answer, but I'm excited to see where it goes, is to meet the demand that we've had since we've launched this. We just get so many emails and requests for this knowledge and for trainings and to help go and show people how to do this. And we're a tiny team. We don't have the capacity right now, but I'm excited to see how we're able to address that challenge.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would it be?
I think the miracle would be, I'd go back, this is kind of cheesy, but go back to those magic glass things. If you could allow every advocate and local official and mayor of every city in the world to be able to put on a pair of glasses and see the potential in their cities and understand what they could do to change that so that they feel empowered how to make a difference. That'd be pretty fun.
You're on the right show then, because the name Sustainable Lens comes from that idea of if you could put on a pair of magic glasses, augmented reality glasses, and
cool,
turn on sustainability mode, what would you see?
That's cool.
And
it turns out
to be quite tricky to say, well, this is what we'd see. But in this case, you've got the
thing from the glasses. We're trying to help people see what's possible.
Yeah, because we're not going to actually get to these glasses.
Exactly. Well, so, I don't know. Maybe we should try and make them.
We came close with Google Glasses. It looked like it was going to happen in that direction, but it's still actually quite hard to think, well, actually, this is what I'm seeing that's different. So in this case, you've done the work to say this is what we need to see.
Closest thing we've got so far.
Yeah, exactly. Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I'd say, look, open your eyes and be open to change. Like, try not to be a naysayer, and I'm sure you've got a lot of really positive, active people listening to this. And if you are one of those people, then try and find a way to make your voice heard, because we don't hear enough of those positive voices. And you know, just sit, take 5 minutes, take 10 minutes today or tomorrow and try and think of one thing that you could do in your daily action, professional or not, that you could do to make a difference. Maybe it's a phone call or a request, or if you're a designer, it's a drawing something slightly differently. But try and think what you can do to remind ourselves. It seems so basic, but that our cities are for people, and we've lost sight of that a little bit.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Joining
this is
me.
Fun. Thanks.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. I'm being joined today by Sky Duncan, who is the director of the Global Designing Cities Initiative at the National Association of City Transportation Officials. You can get through it quite quickly if you hurry.
I know, my goodness.
We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org. That was the Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.